You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings, and we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And this week, we are jumping back into the ancient world of the epistles. And in the fall, we looked at the individual epistles to get a taste for each one and its own particular flavor. But this quarter, we'll be looking at the letters more broadly as a whole to learn their wider themes and to ask them questions. And as we talked about last quarter, these letters are not just theological treaties, but these are real-life examples of people trying to live faithfully to Jesus in a brand new context. So we see them taking the story of Jesus and applying it to their new world and new reality. And so we want to do the same. We want to think about some of the big issues of our day and wonder, what do the scriptures, in particular the epistles, have to say about these things? What can we learn about living faithfully in our context by the way they were living faithfully in theirs? And so this week, the big topic in question on the table is, what do the epistles have to say about race, racism, power, and justice? And obviously, these are major issues in our country and on our minds. And we have a friend of the podcast and resident smart person, Dr. Rick Morris, on to take us through some of the texts that might be helpful to help us think this through and to process what it might look like to live faithfully in response to them. And I'm thankful for Rick's keenness in seeing the bridges from the scriptures to today. And on a personal note, I could tell in this conversation that I'm sort of mid-processing much of this stuff, which means there's a lot of trying out ideas here. And I fear that my own lack of clarity or conclusiveness might be disorienting or frustrating. And I'm hoping that the processing is helpful. But if it's anything other than that, and you'd like a chance to say something about it, I'll put my contact info in the show notes. But to launch this conversation, I want to read a quote from N.T. Wright, and I think it's a good starting place because it focuses this massive conversation specifically on what this means for the church, which is where I want to start. So he says, "What we now call racism is not simply for Christians a failure to obey one or other moral standard. For example, that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. It is deeper even than that. It is a failure of vocation. The church of the anointed Jesus was designed from the start to be a worldwide family, God's new model of human life. The church in our generation has struggled not very successfully to reimagine and sometimes to put into practice something that was always in Christian DNA, but which we have all but forgotten, that we were and are supposed to be in our personal and in our corporate lives, small working models of the ultimate new creation, which God has promised to make and has launched decisively in raising Jesus from the dead. That has always been our glorious vocation. So rejecting racism and embracing the diversity of Jesus' family ought to be as obvious as praying the Lord's Prayer, celebrating the Eucharist, or reading the four Gospels. It isn't just an extra rule we're supposed to keep. It is constitutive of who we are." Enjoy the podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to Your Pod and Your Staff. It is good to be here, and I'm not alone today, as I'm never alone. But this morning, we have a first-time guest on the podcast. His name is Rick Morris. What's going on, my man?
Not too much, just enjoying a beautiful West Sacramento morning.
That's right. And we have Stanford Gibson back in the studio. It's good to have you, man.
Hey, guys.
You took a break for our relationship series, which you should take as no sign that you don't have a wisdom to offer, almost a sign that you have too much wisdom to offer, and we want to hear it later, okay?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to rolling those talks out.
Well, Rick, my friend, you're a friend of the pod. You sometimes text me and talk about, hey, Christian had a good point on that podcast. Oh, yeah, what Stanford had to say was great on that podcast.
I do every now and then.
Well, it's good to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
You are an FBC resident smart person. And what I mean by that is that you just recently, about a year ago, received your three letters, PhD, in philosophy from UC Davis. Stop me if I'm saying anything that's incorrect.
You're good so far.
That's right. So you are Dr. Rick Morris.
Yes, if I were to be extremely tedious as a person, yes.
Or very just accurate. So I'm talking with two doctors, and so I'm the not smart guy in the room. But just so you know this, so you are the FBC resident smart person. We've had other resident smart people in the past, hashtag Tim Houck, hashtag Justin Morton, but you're the only one left. And so until – I hate to break this to you, but until another one comes, you're stuck here. we need you, okay?
Well, I feel so like you got a very low bar here if this is if I'm qualifying, but I will humbly accept the honor.
Yeah. Well, before we dive into what we're going to dive into, just so we can get a little flavor for you and just your who you are and also what kind of mind you have, I wanted you to, which I barely mentioned this to you, so this is you're like half on the spot, but could you convince us of the veracity of your dissertation in 60 seconds?
Well, I'm the apparently resident FBC smart person, so my word should be good enough. If you accept my dissertation, you're willing to say on the pod that you think it's right, then the next time I see you both, I will buy you a beverage of your choice.
Wow.
So I feel like this should be a pretty good argument for being convinced. And I feel like it also takes less explanation. But for those who are curious, I wrote a dissertation on evolutionary mismatch, which is about how...
Sounds like a game show.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting, yes. But the game of life, really. No, it's about how environments change and populations change while they're in those environments. They evolve to fit into those environments better. And sometimes when the environment changes a little too quickly, the population can't quite keep up and bad things can happen. And so I was interested in it in particular because of the way human environments have changed over the last 10,000 years, going from hunting and gathering to agriculture. And I mean, it was sort of inspired by a lot of the whole paleo diet, barefoot running stuff. But in the dissertation, I'm more focused on, you know, this concept applied more broadly across life rather than just human health. And I engage with some of the problems with the paleo diet and all that.
I see. I gotcha. Hey, are you a paleo diet, barefoot running kind of guy?
No, I used to be more of that.
Let me ask you this question. I only asked you that one to set you up for this one.
Yeah.
Do you like kombucha?
I have never had kombucha.
I accidentally had kombucha the other day. I thought I was picking up a can of lemonade and it ended up being kombucha. And boy, was it bad.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to pick any kombucha fights.
That's a pretty hot take.
Especially early on in the podcast. We usually reserve those for later on.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, Rick, it's so great to have you here and really excited for this conversation. And also, I feel like I have a little bit of thoughts on a lot of the topics that are surrounding this conversation. And so I'm excited to have this conversation and start to maybe have some things crystallize or at least get a little more clarity. But I want to give a little bit of a sense of where we're going as a ministry, both on the podcast on Tuesday nights. So we just spent 3 weeks talking about relationships, which was great, surprisingly great, to be honest. And now we're just totally switching gears and pivoting back to what we were doing in the fall, which in the fall we were going through basically the individual epistles to look at their individual shape, their sort of individual interests in different contexts of the different cities that they were written to. And really fun to do. And I feel like the epistles popped for me in a new way. And we always had the plan of sort of doing it in this way of doing all the individual epistles so we can get a feel for them as individual letters and then go back and think, okay, what are some themes or what are some ideas that maybe run through some of the epistles so we can get a flavor of them as a broad unit as well as the individual specific unit. And so that's what we're going to do the rest of this quarter, is that we are going to both look at themes that are happening in the epistles and also just questions that we might have as 21st century readers of these epistles. And so we might have some conversations that are purely like, hey, this is something that Paul seems to care deeply, deeply, deeply about. And we can see that because it shows up in Ephesians and Romans and, you know, also all over the place. Or it might be, hey, we have some questions as people who are reading these letters now. And, you know, it seems like there are some things that could relate to it in Paul, or there's some things that might speak to these different questions that we might have. And so we're going to see if we can sort of pinpoint what Paul cares about and see if that has any bridges to the questions we might have today. So what we're going to do today with Rick and Stanford is we're going to talk about the questions that we have. It's a big topic, obviously, today. We've talked about it on the podcast with Rafiq, of just these questions of race, racism, power, privilege, all these things that are just swirling everywhere right now. And it feels like the scriptures have something to say about these things. But kind of what is it? You know, what do the scriptures have to say? If we want to get wisdom on how to think about these things and move forward in these things, can we get any from the scriptures? And particularly, can we get any from the New Testament? And even more particularly, can we get any from Paul and the epistles as they're trying to form the church? So, okay, is that enough of an introduction of sort of our pivot as a community? Any other questions of where we're going, what we're doing from you guys?
I think so. It might just be worth saying we're saving the last 2 weeks for Revelation because there are lots of questions on that. And in a 4-year cycle where we're trying to introduce the whole scripture, we would be derelict if we didn't at least touch on the apocalypse.
Right. And I think we want to be a community that is a little bit fearless in what we try to talk about, you know, and in the sense of there might be some things that that's a little too much to do in 2 weeks. So it's a little too much to do in a 20-minute talk. It's like, well, we still want to prepare people. We still want people to know the scriptures and love the scriptures and think that they matter for real life. And that's hopefully what we're going to do today, too, is think about some of the things that are hard to think about or at least are charged and see what the scriptures have to say. And I feel really excited about grounding our conversation in let's talk about some things that show up in the epistles and then see what that means for the rest of the questions that we might have today. And so, Rick, I know that this is not what you got your PhD in, but you are passionate about these things. And just to sort of set it up, FBC is in a process of trying to learn and study and think about the church's response to issues of race and racism and justice in the world, and particularly in America. And so there's a subcommittee of people and thinking about those things, and you are one of those people. So great to have a subcommittee person on the team with us. But so these thoughts have kind of been in your mind, I think, for some months now. So thanks for coming in and chatting with us today.
Sure, happy to be here.
Anything you want to say to set up the conversation?
So I just wanted to actually add on to a little bit of what you and Stanford said, that you know, this is a conversation where we're thinking through some of these issues. This is not, despite the fact that we're looking at Holy Writ, this is not Holy Writ.
Right.
And we are, we're three white guys grappling with some difficult questions. Some, you know, probably some of us have been thinking about them for longer. Some of us have had different experiences, but, you know, that certainly I welcome, you know, any feedback or follow on conversations that people want to have with me after this. And I'm not looking at this as kind of, you know, this, I have now gone to the scriptures. I have found the answers. This is everything the Bible has to say. This is more like how I've been thinking about it, particularly in light of the epistles, the most recent theme for college life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I still have lots to learn. And, you know, I think maybe it's also valuable to note that kind of as a community, you know, we're a little bit behind on some of this. And so, we are not trailblazers. There are other people who've been long out in front on this, and we are trying to kind of, well, I'll say I'm trying to catch up and trying to learn. And so this is not me coming in and teaching all the true facts about this issue. This is, you know, me maybe trying to show what it looks like when somebody's trying to understand and trying to learn, you know, how I've been thinking about it as a result.
Yeah. Someone sort of in process of thinking, not necessarily someone who's arrived and is saying, hey, come look at everything that I've learned. So.
Right. Exactly.
No, that's helpful. I appreciate that. Let's just dive in to particularly, Rick, what you have been seeing in the scriptures as you've looked. And what I was hoping for is that we'd have two sections of this conversation. We'd have the exegesis section, which is a dumb word that is basically just, you know, what's the text saying, close reading of the text, which can include historical context, just what's going on in the text, you know, and try to keep the conversation focused on that before we then zoom out to be like, what's this look like in the world? So we have two sections. One would be the exegesis section and one would be the y-egesis section. So that was
which is not a word. It's not just a dumb word. It's like
that's a
not
made up
actually
word.
A word.
Yeah. But yeah. X and Y I thought was good. And then the question of why, it's pretty elegant, yeah. I thought. Yeah.
It's chromosomal.
That is better than I initially thought it was.
Yeah. So basically that's what we're going to do. And so, Rick, can you just take us in to some of the texts that you've been looking at and maybe organizing it around how these things are connecting to the questions we're talking about or the themes we're talking about?
Sure. So I think maybe one thing that's good to lead with here for early Christian cultural context, you'll see, I mean, we're looking mostly at Galatians, Colossians, James today, and then a bit of Romans, maybe if we have time for it. But one of the background things that's going on here is conflict in the early church between Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians, mm-hmm. Where at least some Jewish Christians thought that to become a Jesus follower, Gentiles should be circumcised or should at least adopt perhaps some of the food laws.
Right.
And Gentiles
Sabbath.
Who... Yeah. Yes, right, exactly. Yeah. Sabbath practices and Gentiles who, you know, particularly understandably on that first one, were a little reluctant to adopt, you know, the full practices of traditional Judaism. So, I mean, there's sort of that tension between, you know, is your faith or is your participation in following Jesus really authentic if you're not doing the things that Jesus did and that all of Jesus' ancestors and all of his, you know, us, his fellow Jews did. And then there's kind of, you know, maybe a little bit of like older brother, little brother kind of going on, mm-hmm. Where, you know, we're the seasoned kind of important people.
Right.
You know, where this might be like the perspective of some Jews, some Jewish Christians, and then, and you know, so who are you to kind of come along and tell us what it means to follow, you know, the Jewish Messiah? And so that's kind of some of what's going on in the background here. Particularly, I think you can see this coming out a lot in Galatians. Colossians is interesting in that it seems to be maybe a little more syncretism going on, perhaps some pagan teaching and some Jewish teaching that are kind of getting mixed up in there. But we can look at Galatians first because I think it's a clearer piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mention all this to kind of set up what I think is probably one of the most intuitively clear or most intuitively obvious go-to texts, you know, anti-racist texts in the epistles in particular. Mm-hmm. And so maybe what I'll do is we'll give the text and then we'll back up a little bit. Okay, so given that background of disputes between Jews and Gentiles, you come eventually to Galatians 3:28. Which says, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. There's the sense that we have a new identity, a new unity in Christ. What comes before that, which is worth mentioning, is really Paul kind of, I mean, among other things, he's sort of defending his own status as a Jew, as saying, you know, I was circumcised on the eighth day. I kept the laws. I am, you know, somebody who you should think of as a pretty good example of what it means to be a Jew. And I'm telling you that, you know, that this is not the stuff that makes you a Christian. Mm-hmm. There's an incident that is recorded in Galatians 2, a dispute or a conflict between Paul and Peter.
This is the best. I love this. This is one of the greatest parts of all the epistles to me.
Scene. So, I love it. Would you like to tell the story since it's one of your favorite parts? That'd be great.
Sure. I'll try my best. So Paul is essentially, you know, seen as like the apostle to the Gentiles, and Peter is seen primarily, I guess, like the apostle to the Jewish people, right? And so Peter has been going through some of these. Is a little maybe slower than Paul to realize the new identity in Christ and to realize that some of these particularly Jewish markers are not the way into the family of God. And one of the things that's like really, really important in this season of sort of a new wave of identity, and again, the markers not being the thing that are, or the religious traditional things like circumcision or feast laws or Sabbath are not the thing that defines you as in the family of Jesus, but it is just allegiance to Jesus, is like table fellowship. Who do you eat dinner with and who do you sort of surround yourself with? Because what you're doing then is you're sort of, if you eat dinner with someone, have table fellowship with someone, you are treating them, casting them as an equal, saying that they are part of my tribe, they are part of my family. And so Peter has like starts to go down the road of like he's living into this. He's eating with the Gentile Christians. He's having table fellowship with them, communicating to them, you are part of my family. We are all sort of one united family. And then some of the elites from Jerusalem come. And they're not happy about Gentile believers coming into the family. They're like, no, we've done this one way this whole time. Why, we're not going to throw away everything we've done just because new Gentile believers or whatever. I'm editorializing what they're saying. This is what I imagine the scene being. And then Peter gets spooked And he goes right back into his old ways and refuses table fellowship with the Gentile believers and sort of fences himself off and is communicating in what he's doing that this is like to be a Jesus follower, to be part of this family, you have to be ethnically Jewish. You can't be this Gentile person who just happens to love Jesus and trust Jesus. You have to be a Jewish person, which is not what they agreed on, right? And so Paul just scolds him publicly and gets pretty furious with him, essentially saying, this is not the logic of what this is. You're not living into the truth and the logic of where the story's going. You know, you're living a false story now. So anyway, that was off the top of my head. But anything else from that scene that pops for either of you guys?
No, I think, I mean, that was a great summary and a better one than I would have given. So I appreciate you taking that. Yeah.
It's so good. It's rare that you get a like sort of this narrative element mm-hmm. in the middle of an mm-hmm. epistle. Yeah, I think that's absolutely. Why it pops so much.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that gives us, I mean, it's really, I think, you know, Paul giving some of the sort of the cultural background really that we need there, which is that there's this active dispute. Mm-hmm. It's live and there are sort of different, you know, different very important leaders in the church are taking different positions. And, you know, it's really having an effect mm-hmm. Where all the people who yeah. thought Peter was cool with them, suddenly, you know, he's acting like they're a bunch of nerds that he doesn't want to be seen with, and he wants to go sit at the cool kids' table, essentially.
Right.
That's all in the Bible, kids. No need to check up on me on that.
Right.
Yeah.
And, a bunch of nerds, yeah.
And yeah, so that's kind of like, you know, part of really what's going on in the background here in Galatians. And so when we get to the discussion, you know, where Paul kind of expounds again on the relationship of faith and works. And in particular, what he's really doing is he's pointing back to Abraham again, like he does in Romans, as kind of, you know, this sort of exemplar of belief. But he's doing that because Abraham is the patriarch of the Jewish people. And so essentially what he's saying is like, Gentiles can be like him too. Gentiles can become part of Abraham's family and become Christians. Or become faithful Jesus followers, and that it is through faith rather than through correct obedience to the law that we take on this new identity. And this new identity, where there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, because we're all one, they can take on this new identity, and this new identity is, and here where Paul contrasts it, he says we become sons rather than slaves. We're no longer slaves to the law, bound by the law. We now become sons, not, you know, all male children, but rather we become inheritors of what was promised to Abraham.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, and I think the idea of the metaphor there is family across difference, right? Like, this is one of the great texts of mm-hmm. Of otherness, of difference. One of the like really remarkable things about the church in those early years is that it sought to build a family out of like the real, like almost violent diversity of the ancient Roman world. And it just seemed like a bad idea. This is not how you form a movement. You form a movement out of finding similar people and bringing them together. And you can just see throughout the letters is that Paul's finding this hard, right? Because making a family across difference, the technical term here is merism. He uses these poles where the two opposing things are meant to symbolize the whole. It's part of, you know, part of the Hebrew poetry. And he's just saying, listen, you may not always get along with your siblings, but they're your family. You know, we're always telling our kids this, is that like you are going to be each other's people for the rest of your life. You need to learn to get along. But he's saying this to people who aren't related and actually have like large cultural and phenotypic differences.
Yeah. When you wrap your mind around the project that they're trying to do, that Paul cares so much about, it's bonkers to me.
Yeah.
Because even if you think about now, like people's religious and then ethnic and cultural identities are so core to who they are and feel so core and feel so unmoving that it's like, well, there's just fundamental differences in the way that we eat, the way that we sing, the way that we worship, the way that we talk, the way that we joke, the way, you know, all these things, the way that we see the world, then to think, yeah, okay, granted, that's all true. Now we're going to live together as family. Now we're all going to share a particular identity being followers of Jesus that is going to be above that, but not erase all that, you know? But we're going to have to live as if that top identity, being followers of Jesus, is the most important for our bonds. I don't know. It feels catastrophically difficult. And we see, I guess, so much of the tension that we see now and then is a result of it's hard to bring that amount of people with that level of difference together. And yet it seems like that's what Paul's saying. That's exactly what we need to do. Right. Like, it's so hard. If there was an easier way to live into this, we would do that.
But really, this is this kind of eventual unity is, I think, kind of part of the picture of what we see in the Jewish scriptures. In of course, you know, all citations are leaving my mind at this moment. But right, kind of this picture of everybody right. coming to recognize the God of Israel as God, and right. you know, if we're fast forwarding to Revelation, every tribe and tongue and nation worshiping together.
Right.
And I mean, it's really. I don't know. I just want to dwell on it for a moment. I don't know if either of you guys have had a chance to participate in a worship service outside of the United States, or ideally with elements of, you know, not of a language that you don't speak.
I have. Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I wish that I liked it more. By the way, I wish that I wasn't more uncomfortable
or bored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or bored. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, continue. Don't want to step on your point.
Yeah. Yeah, well, apparently, so I think it's pretty cool.
Thank you, thank you.
But
you're better than us.
I'm a little more enlightened. Yeah, I understand. You both know this. Some of the listeners may know this, some won't. So my wife Karis is Malaysian, by which I mean she was born and grew up in Malaysia, and her father's a pastor back home in Malaysia, and so I've attended church there. And for those of you who don't know this, Malaysia is as much an English-speaking country as anything else. So I follow pretty much everything in my father-in-law's church services, except they also speak in Malaysia. They speak Bahasa Malaysia, which just means the Malaysian language. Mm. And so they occasionally sing hymns I guess I'll be pedantic here, in Bahasa Indonesia, which is the Indonesian language, and it's basically mutually intelligible because Malaysia is an Islamic country, and Indonesia has a lot more Christians. Anyway, so they sing hymns in Indonesian, and I do not understand them. but the thing that that it really brought home for me having that experience was the thought, like, because I can kind of pick out, or Karis would like sometimes translate some of the words for me. The thing that really brought it home for me was just thinking, like, it was the chance to enter into this sort of ancient and worldwide community of believers, where all of us on our Sunday mornings or Saturday nights or whatever gathered together saying these same prayers or very similar ones, the same, you know, talking to the same God, you know, just united in that, you know, in the family of God. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I found it quite powerful to really have that brought home for me. It was something, of course, that I, you know, knew and believed.
Right, but to experience it.
Right, is just quite, yeah, it's quite different.
Yeah.
And that really, but that made it real for me in a way that even than in other places where I don't have any experience, I feel more connected in that sense that, like, that we're all sharing in this experience together, this kind of, you know, of following Jesus together.
Yeah.
Even despite these, across these radical differences, like you all have been talking about, and like, you know, Paul is grappling with in Galatians and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of, I guess, thump the table on that a lot, because there's something, you know, deeper in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we see some of this in the history of, like, missionary work, Western missionary work in particular, where we see, and I don't know a ton about this, so if I, you know, mess up any of the history, one of you is welcome to correct me, but, you know, my understanding is that a lot of, particularly during the British Empire, a lot of particularly British missionaries would show up, they'd preach the gospel, but they would also be preaching the gospel of, you know, British culture.
Right.
And you should dress a certain way, and you should engage, you know, have certain other practices and values, which are, you know, the values, you know, of empire rather than the values of following Jesus necessarily. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have, or some missionaries at some times at least have not had that same kind of, you know, radically multicultural and radically pluralist view of following Jesus or of the family of God. It's been kind of adopting this more Western model.
Right.
Or Western English-speaking model.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So if we try to think back to just what is being said in Galatians, the general, yes. It seems like the the point you're wanting to highlight is that Paul is saying that there is no ethnic marker for what it means to be a Jesus follower, a Christian. There is no Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There's no male or female. You are all one in Christ Jesus, right? That the point is that there's this unity in Christ that is now the marker of this family. It's no longer these different either ethnic divides or gender divides, anything like that. No, there's no divide. There's nothing but allegiance to Jesus. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is that sort of what we're hoping to say about the Galatians passage as it relates to this conversation?
Yeah, or at least that those divides should be kind of dropping away or decreasing in importance in light of the fact that we are all part of, you know, God's family, you know, grafted onto the family of Abraham.
Yeah. Yeah. So not that these things disappear in terms of, you know, that they might matter to someone's identity, but that they are demoted in terms of importance of belonging to this family. That in terms of what it means to be a part of this family, it does not matter what kind of person you are, where you might be from, what you might look like. What matters is you have allegiance to Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's right.
And so Richard Hayes, who's one of the big New Testament scholars of r/the last generation, he summarized this by saying that Galatians is one of the scripture's most powerful witnesses against cultural imperialism. The idea that within the church, one group, kind of asserting its cultural ascendancy is just out of bounds.
That's really interesting. Okay. I want to talk more about that. I'm sure that theme will come up as we keep going. So any other passages, Rick, that you can show us? So we got the Galatians one in our tool belt now. Anything else?
So I'm thinking, actually, I'm wondering if maybe in the interest of time, because, you know, I've got somewhere else that I want to go eventually here, mm-hmm. as you both know. I might just also point out that there's a similar thing going on in Colossians. So there is that Colossians 3 passage, Colossians 3:11. Here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, or free, but Christ is all and in all. Mm. And some of you can see some of the same echoes or similar echoes of questions about, you know, following the law, or, you know, which cultural practices are mandatory. You see some of that also in Colossians, but I guess a lot of what I would have to say here is probably similar.
And yeah, it's a little bit of a repeat.
Can I just make a couple of distinctions about the Colossians passage? Because the Colossians passage does intensify things a little bit. These merisms, where we're kind of talking about someone who has good standing or high status and someone who has low standing or low status, and kind of crossing the divide and representing the whole. Paul does something really quirky here in the poetry, is that he adds barbarian and Scythian, which isn't someone with high status and someone with low status. It's someone with low status and someone with lower status. And so he's done something poetically interesting here to actually broaden the table and not just say, hey, we're all kind of the same here. Like, he's like, no, we're actually like aggressively embracing difference. And we, you know, the barbarians, you know, it's like anyone who's not Greek, you know, it's like the contemporary word Hispanic, where it's like everyone who speaks Spanish from South and Central America. Yeah. It's like, it's not a really descriptive term. It includes lots of difference in rich cultural heritage. But then he goes on to, you know, of the barbarians, the Scythians are, you know, they're the steppe nomads. They're the ones that we particularly don't like. They would be like the slur. And so he's doing something very interesting here to even expand over what he did in Galatians.
Wait, okay, let me see if I understand what you're saying. So you're saying this merism is essentially giving the bottom of the spectrum and the top of the spectrum in order to say the whole spectrum.
Right.
So it's like if you were saying, like, you can eat broccoli or pizza, meaning you could eat anything. Is that like...
I would go with Brussels sprouts, but yes.
Yeah, sure. And then in Colossians, he adds some stuff that feels like it's on the bottom of the spectrum.
Right.
Is it even further on the bottom?
He's pushing the low status part of the spectrum. Instead of just saying, hey, it's everybody, he's saying it's everybody, but also let's make sure we're really explicit about which part of the everybody you might be tended to exclude or and so it's almost aggressively inclusive in a way that the Galatians passage, which Hayes calls the most powerful witness against cultural imperialism, it's this hold my beer.
So I'm just thinking here a little extemporaneously, but so I'm wondering, because he starts out similarly, right, with there's not Greek and Jew, and as you pointed out, Stanford, right, the sort of opposition here was typically Greek and barbarian. Mm-hmm. And so kind of he starts it out kind of like he's setting it up to say, okay, so, you know, Jewish people, you shouldn't be looking down on your fellow Christians who are not Jews, which is kind of how it's starting down. And then he says, oh, and by the way, Greeks, I see you over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Thinking, well, I'm not a barbarian. You gotta.
Yeah.
And saying, no, the barbarians are in too. Yeah. Even the Scythians are in.
That's right. Yeah.
And I kind of wonder if that's also pointing to some of the broader kind of syncretistic context
of Colossians.
Of possibly what's going on in. Yeah, exactly, of Colossians, mm-hmm. where it's not just about disputes between Jewish and Gentile Christians.
Yeah. Mm. And also, I can't read this passage without hearing Andrew Bird's haunting song, Scythian Empire. So that's free.
Never heard of Andrew Bird. Sure, he's transcendent musical artist.
Yeah.
It is interesting to me. Obviously, we're having this conversation about the epistles, but it does seem to me like this idea doesn't have much legs. You know, and because it could be such an unpalatable idea to someone, especially who is pretty comfortable in the community they're in and doesn't necessarily want it to change, doesn't want the influx of new thought or new cultures or new whatever, that if you don't have a deep foundational understanding that all people are the image of God, you know, have imago Dei, mm-hmm. if you don't have that the basic understanding of what a human being is, this will not work. Can't imagine how it could work. This call seems so big and so profound that if you just have like goodwill toward people, just a general goodwill toward people, and you think that's going to make it happen, I can't believe that that's true. It just seems too hard. But if you have and continue to submit yourself to a deep, profound understanding of what a human being is, which the scriptures lay out, then you work out the logical outflowing of that, then you might be able to land somewhere that like where Paul is landing. So anyway, all I want to say is like that fundamental and deep posture towards valuing each person as imago Dei seems really instrumental here. But you sound like, Rick, that we're talking about this sort of unity in Christ. We are all sort of like no ethnic barriers, no other barriers to being in the family of God. I hear in your voice that there's another thing you also want to talk about. So can you like maybe pivot our conversation toward the next thing that you're interested in? Or the next thing you see in the scriptures is relating to the topics of race and racism and all that stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
So these are the passages that I immediately think of when somebody asks, what does the Bible have to say about race and racism? I think these are like really intuitively obvious. I don't think they're wrong.
Yeah.
But I think perhaps particularly maybe the white American church has had a tendency to just kind of say, yeah, we just all become Christians, and then what's everybody's problem? We'll just be Christians, and we're done.
Right.
And I think that's essentially kind of a simplistic or maybe naive approach. So I think there's more we need to unpack. And I guess maybe what we'll do is we can look at the next scriptures we're going to look at, and then we can maybe double back and look at some of our own cultural context and why that's so significant. Mm-hmm. So with that, I would like to turn to James, basically the end of James 1 into James 2.
The heading is the sin of partiality in my Bible.
Yes. So I know this makes me a bad FBC member, but I have an NIV in front of me rather than an ESV. So the important part that I want to hit on here, I think this just kind of, you know, works relatively well on its own, is starting around in, well, it's basically verse 127, which I will read in the NIV here defiantly, because it sets kind of the tone, I think, for a lot of what we want to talk about. So religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world.
Gosh, so interesting. So interesting.
And so we think, okay, yeah, widows and orphans, that's really sad and tragic. We should take care of them. Sounds good, James. Cool. Mm-hmm. Not really sure why they're so important here. It's like, that's like half of being a faithful Christian. But so here's why. If you actually dive into really, I mean, if you dive into the Bible, but especially if you dive into the Bible with a focus on justice, mm-hmm. Which is part of what we've been doing for this little working group over the past few months, widows and orphans come up a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's almost kind of like an idiom. Widows, orphans, the poor, and the alien, or
sojourner.
The, you know, or the sojourner, the traveler, the immigrant, something like that. They're paired so often that I kind of tend to assume, maybe this is bad exegesis, I don't know. One of you MDiv types can tell me this, but I kind of tend to assume that if one of them is mentioned,
all of them
there's
are
sort of a presumption yeah. that the rest of them are kind of assumed. And so as part of our working group, we read lots of what the Bible has to say about justice and a lot of Christians have had to say about justice. As going through the Bible, thinking, why do these kind of four usually show up together just over and over? What is the common theme? And the common theme, I think, and I think this is not a particularly original insight, is that it's powerlessness. Mm-hmm. If you are a widow or an orphan, you have lost your in a patriarchal society. I should clarify this, right? In a patriarchal society, you're a widow or an orphan. You've lost your sort of your patriarch. You've lost the guy who's responsible for making sure you're taken care of.
Yeah,
who's your powerful ally, the one who kind of gets to speak and say how things go. Now you don't have that protection anymore. And if you are poor, you might have a patriarch, so to speak, in a sense, but you no longer have the material means to sort of compel people to respect your family or to, you know, to treat them well, or to just survive.
Right.
You lack material power, which then downstream means you lack social power. Mm. And similarly, of course, with the sojourner, the alien, whatever you'd like to call it, you have the same thing where this person is cut off from their home community. Mm-hmm. Or they're at least no longer, they're not in their home community right now. So the sort of network of support that you would expect in a both patriarchal and collectivistic society, where your tribe or your clan or your family is going to have your back, the alien does not have that. Mm-hmm. They're lacking allies. They're kind of standing on their own. And so just over and over throughout the scriptures, we see God's people called to take special care of these people.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be for these people, to be like in favor of these people. In Job, when Job is defending himself, and I think it's in chapter 26, talks about how he sought out the cause of the oppressed. He broke the fangs of the oppressor. There's this return over and over in the Bible to this theme of how people who were powerful, because mm-hmm. Job was a wealthy man, right? How people who are powerful should be, seeking out and looking after those who do not have power, should be empowering them. And you see the Bible in Leviticus 25, setting up the Jubilee year, we won't need to go into the whole thing, but basically setting up a system of property ownership in ancient Israel where no family can really accrue that much wealth and power
right.
before the wealth goes back to the original owner. And kind of people return to a more equal footing. Mm-hmm. So when we see James here talking about widows and orphans and looking after widows and orphans in their distress, I think we should be hearing in his words echoes of this whole biblical tradition of looking after the least of these.
Yeah.
Right. Jesus also includes in them, prisoners are included in this as well. But people who are, have been disempowered by their society. What James is saying, I take him to be saying, is that basically half of being a faithful Christian is looking after those people, mm-hmm. is identifying those people in your society and then taking care of them.
Yeah.
And so we see this then kind of some of this modeled as we move into chapter 2 here, where my NIV study Bible says favoritism forbidden.
That's more alliterative than
yeah.
the sin of partiality. Yeah.
Yeah, so here we can just take a look at, I guess we can actually just sketch it. The idea, the image that James is giving us is of presumably a house church where there's like the rich guy who you want to be, you want to schmooze with, you want to be friends with. So you're like kind of trying to sit with him. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of the poor guy who maybe can't do as much for you, or maybe he's just less cool or, you know, more awkward, whatever you'd like to say, where you're not as drawn to hang out with him, mm-hmm. particularly because of the social differences there. And James is essentially saying, if you're treating the rich guy better, you're failing as a Christian. You are not acting faithfully.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, again, we can kind of go back to the almost naive idea, which is that of, you know, Galatians and Colossians, where we're saying, you know, treat everybody the same, which, you know, and there's that, right, that we are all one in Christ and we should really live into that shared identity, but also that we should be attentive to people who don't have power. Mm. Where you almost see, I mean, in other places, I mean, even in the end of James, in James 5, we talked about this yesterday, Peter, that, mm-hmm. you know, there's some scary stuff threatened for rich people. God basically casts down thrones and casts down rulers and, you know, breaks the proud. There's really this sense throughout the Bible of God kind of subverting,
yeah.
you know, elevating, you know, the least of these. And breaking down those who are powerful. Mm. This is like, I think, a core Christian ethic. And of course, it's what Jesus does on the cross. He becomes one of the least of these,
yeah.
you know, shamed and disgraced before the empire, and therefore, you know, achieves victory over sin and death in doing so. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I mean, I think like when we want to think about how Christians, or when we as Christians want to think about racism, we should really be concerned with this idea of power and powerlessness, or yeah. you know, in our sort of modern contemporary parlance, talking about privilege and oppression. Mm-hmm. This should be like a core idea. So that's, yeah.
Go ahead. Let me see if I can trace what, like, the two things that we've said and see if this is jiving. So the first idea from the Galatians and the Colossians, this unity in Christ, has to do with status in terms of belonging and to this particular family, that there should be no status marker that makes someone more a part of this family than anyone else, right? And then it seems like what you're pointing out from the James passage, and as you connect it to the broader biblical theme of caring for the weak and the powerless, is this has nothing to do with status necessarily in terms of belonging to the family of God, but it is the work of this particular family to pay attention to the station of people's lives, you know, that it's not it, like everyone has equal standing and everyone has equal status in this family, but our eyes and our ethic ought to be drawn to those who don't have the power, who don't have power in society or even in the church or whatever. It doesn't seem like it's like, hey, I thought we were all equal. Now you're telling me that we're not equal. I think they're two different ideas. One is we're all equal in status, belonging to God. And then the other one is, yes, and once we're all equal, once we're all in this family, our eyes ought to be drawn, and again, our ethic and what we should do, we should move towards those people without power, in sort of the language you're putting it, and live for their blessing, I guess. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, I think that's right. And yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of assumed in the way James flows right from saying, look after widows and orphans, mm-hmm. almost kind of saying, therefore, don't show favoritism. And he doesn't literally say therefore, but, you know.
Right.
And so the immediate next thing he goes to is, so you shouldn't be showing favoritism. And he explicitly links this to loving your neighbor as yourself. So
yeah.
if we're going to be, you know, living this, you know, proper Christian ethic, if we're going to be, you know, choosing not to show favoritism, well, the world is always already showing favoritism to these powerful people.
Yeah.
So, you know, inherently, at least, you know, within the church, there's going to be some elevation if we're going to not show the world's favoritism.
I see. So because there could be an obvious critique of like, hey, if we're not supposed to show favoritism, why are we showing favoritism to the poor? Right? That's literally what you just told us not to do. But you're making a little bit of an argument of already the people in power are getting all the favoritism, you know, just like, mm-hmm. just in general, it's how human beings have worked. Those in power get our love, affection, attention, favors, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, hey, in order to not do that as the church, we need to intentionally shift the pendulum toward the powerless so we don't show favoritism to the upper mobility.
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly.
So it might feel like you're showing favoritism to the poor, but really what you're doing on a meta level is you are shifting the pendulum more toward justice.
Right. And I mean, in the way, I mean, we can just use a family metaphor where if I have a, I don't have any brothers, so I'll just use brothers. If I have a brother who's a surgeon and he makes, you know, $500,000 a year, and I have a brother who does not, maybe he's unemployed or something like that.
Or a pastor. Or, you know, hey, why not a pastor? You can use that. Yeah.
Why not a pastor? Yeah. Let's say, you know, tell my less fortunate brother, hey, you know, hey man, come and live with me. You know, you just come and stay with me. No problem, you know, until you get back on your feet or whatever, as long as it takes. You're my brother. I love you. I'm going to help you. Mm-hmm. And then my wealthy brother comes and says like, oh, so I don't get an invitation to live with you? Mm-hmm. What's going on, man? Like, why don't I get the invitation? You should be, you know, giving me, you know, rent-free room as well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if I really do that, if I treat the two of them the same, if I pretend their circumstances are the same, mm-hmm. then really what I'm doing is I'm just, you know, showing some favoritism to the rich brother.
I see. Yeah.
Because I'm just sort of pretending not to notice the real context of what's going on and not attending to that actual context. I'm just giving the rich brother, you know, one more advantage that in this case he really doesn't need.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sense of like living neutrally will benefit the powerful and continue mm-hmm. to disenfranchise the powerless if you live neutrally. If you live as if nothing, you see you're agnostic to power, right? So in order to balance the scales, I guess, in order to, I don't know if that's the right language, but in order to live into this, we have to focus on the powerless, because that's the only way to bring them justice.
Yes, I think, that's
interesting. Stan, do you have any thoughts?
I think what we're saying is that justice has a proactive element to it.
Yeah.
And, we're being a little bit constrained to the New Testament letters, you know, because that's what we're doing this year in college mm-hmm. life. But you know, this was also going to be a theme before, COVID cut off our spring theme series of the prophets, right? Besides possibly the coming Messiah who's going to make all wrong things right, there isn't a more compelling and pervasive theme in the prophets than, you know, God's desire for justice. And the fact that that's, you know, not just kind of neutral equity, but proactive difference making.
You know, it's interesting about you using the words powerless and powerful and stuff like that. I think you and I are both listening to the Bauer Project series right now. Rick?
Yes.
Yeah. It's funny when you feel like you've read a book because you've heard someone talk about the book over and over, you know? Mm-hmm. But Tim and John keep referencing this book by, is it Scott McKnight? Reading Romans Scott Backwards. Uh-huh. And one of the arguments, I guess, in the book, I haven't read it, is that when Paul uses, or when we read the words like weak and strong in Romans 14, which I know people don't have just Romans 14 in their minds, but it's this really, really wonderful section where Paul is saying, hey, some of you are going to be eating like the ethnic Jewish people. Some of you are going to be doing circumcision. Some of you are going to be doing Sabbath, and some of you aren't, you know? And essentially, it seems like he's saying, both of you get to belong, you know, and just do what you're going to do, but do it for the glory of God. So it's this really wonderful passage, but he calls those who are doing the Sabbath laws and who are getting circumcised and eating the way that like ethnically Jewish people would have eaten. So the kosher food, he calls them like the weak. And then he calls those who don't do those things, the strong. And, what they point out talking about this book is that those words actually should be in power language, that actually for weak, it's actually the powerless, you know, mm-hmm. and the strong, it's actually powerful, like those who have power. And so it's actually and it's probably more complicated of an argument, but the way that I've understood it is like in Rome, the Jewish believers got expelled. They got like sent out. And when they came back, they were of no status. So those are obviously the people who are going to be eating kosher, getting circumcised, doing the Sabbath. And Paul calls them powerless or weak right now because they're so low on the social status. Mm-hmm. Right. And he calls the Gentile Christians who are not doing those things, because why they don't need to belong to Jesus. He's calling them strong. So he's saying, hey, you who are strong or you who have power right now, you need to look at those who are powerless or weak, who are like the Jewish Christians. And you need to like include them in your churches, include them in your family again. And so it's interesting. This power dynamic seems to be at play. And that's interesting because that's almost an exact reversal of how this Jew Gentile in the family of God story started, where it was like in Acts 15. It was the Jewish Christians who were having to be told, you need to include the Gentiles. So it was the Jewish Christians who were in quote-unquote power and the Gentile Christians who were powerless. And now that the situation has inverted itself and Paul is using the same logic to say, it's not that the Jewish Christians need to treat the Gentile Christians in a certain way. It's that the powerful need to treat the powerless in a certain way, which is really interesting. I think that probably builds the bridge to our conversation of the why of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, how do we zoom this conversation out and think about all these things that, you know, aren't mentioning race or racism? How do we build bridges to think about how these ideas impact how we're thinking about this particular conversation? Because one question I had, especially about the James thing, is if they talk about poor and the widows and the orphans, I can imagine that there's some people who just think, okay, well, then we, even now, we should just literally focus on the poor, the widows, and the orphans. So there seems like there is an interpretive move to say, well, when they talk about poor, widows, and the orphans, they're really talking about those without power. And so what we need to do is focus on those without power. But I can imagine someone saying, hey, don't get cute with this. You should just care for the poor, the widows, and the orphans. You should be agnostic to race or any other ethnic marker. You should just care for that. So there is an interpretive move to say what they're talking about is powerlessness, which means we have the freedom to then think who's powerless in our society, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, so I think that's right. And if you just read James, just kind of by itself, this might not leap out as much.
Yeah.
But what I'll do is I'll talk about this kind of in my own experience, you know, doing this kind of justice study for the for our church project on race and racism and biblical justice. I mean, it's just the thing about this, like, of course I knew going in, of course the Bible cares about justice. Like, there's a bunch of that stuff in the prophets and, you know, Jesus says a bunch of stuff. And so, you know, justice really matters to God. Like, I would have told you that, you know, pretty much at any time in my, you know, Christian walk. But I think the experience of actually going through specifically focusing on justice, it is just overwhelming. It's both overwhelming, just like how much this concern with justice pervades the Bible, how close it clearly is to the heart of God, and how these same groups, you know, widows, orphans, poor, sojourners, sometimes prisoners, keep showing up together. Not 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So one way we could take that is like, well, in the exact passages when they show up together, that's when it applies to all of them. And the ones where they don't, you only care about the groups mentioned.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this is the way that I read it. And it is an interpretive move, but I think it's a plausible one, which is we can refer to all of them by kind of gesturing at some of them.
Yeah.
And I guess because they show up together so often, it's all, like I said, it's almost like an abbreviated, you know, you give the abbreviated list of powerless people. When you say, you know, widows and orphans, et cetera, you take care of them. I just think it's really hard to read the Bible with an eye to justice specifically and then not be immediately just like, you know, practically punched in the face with this kind of concern for, or this biblical concern for dealing with power and looking and ensuring that the powerful look after the powerless.
Yeah.
This is sometimes, you know, right, this is sometimes framed as right in the family codes and the letters. This is making sure that fathers are looking after their children and treating them well, or masters are looking after slaves and treating them well, or the rich are taking care of the poor. But it's like, you know, these same kind of dynamic shows up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to kind of drive it all in, Jesus, you know, identifies explicitly with the least of these.
Yeah.
Right. As you treat those who are the least of these, so you're also treating me.
Yeah.
And the way that this list kind of gets, you know, expanded and, you know, shortened in different contexts, I think is just what suggests to me that it's not really intended to be just an exclusive list. It's intended to be kind of a gesture towards this broader dynamic.
Right, right, right. So then we have the interpretive freedom on some level to think that what kind of these verses are after is like, there are people in your society, in your community that are just on the underside of power and for a variety of different reasons. In that particular society, particularly it was widows, orphans, and all these things, right? Because in a patriarchal society, although I'm sure widows and orphans aren't doing so great in our society, even if we wouldn't call it purely patriarchal society, right? But almost particularly, it's like, obviously that's going to be, you almost have no rights, you know? And so then it's like, okay, well then in our cultural context, thinking about who is it who are, I don't want to say powerless. That feels, I guess you could say powerless, or just those who tend to be on the underside of power, those who tend to have
marginalized.
A harder, Yeah, marginalized, sure. Yeah, that may be a better word. Less dehumanizing, maybe, to say mm-hmm. that you're totally powerless.
Right.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So would we wouldn't say necessarily that the epistles are interested in racism per se. The epistles and what we're talking about are interested in race and racism in the sense that they are, or and then we could be interested in the epistles with the theme of racism in our mind because it is the power dynamic issue du jour. Like it is the power disparity issue that we see in our society now.
Yes.
One of, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. That it, yeah. It certainly is at least a, I think, major power dynamic, yes. But yeah. Otherwise, yeah, I agree. I wouldn't say that the Bible, and I don't know when you want to get into our, sort of the our cultural context part, but I would say the Bible doesn't speak about race because race doesn't exist at the time the Bible is being written and composed.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that there's no lessons to take away.
Yeah. That's this really interesting kind of conversation we're having because we want to stick close to the text as Christians in our ethics and in the way we see the world. But also there's things happening in our world that the Bible just does not speak directly to. So we have to think about deeper themes and deeper postures of the text and think about how we can live faithfully into those in a context that didn't exist when the scriptures were being written. So, okay, one question that's nagging at me, and I don't want to dominate this time of questions, but is Paul seems to be interested narrowly in the church, unity in Christ, unity in the family of God, and the conversation swirling in America right now about race and racism and power and privilege and all that stuff might include the church, but it's certainly broader than the church. And it has to do with economic structures and
law enforcement.
Yeah, law enforcement. Yeah. It's massive conversation. It's mm-hmm. it's almost all encompassing. And so what do we take from these texts about our politics, and not necessarily right or left politics, but just like how we engage with the state? How do we engage in the city? How do we engage in like society outside of the church? Like it feels like this is a conversation, like an in-house conversation that Paul's having. Like it's mm-hmm. like, hey, let's gather all of our parishioners and let's be like, hey, do we look like what Paul's saying? And are we living into this as the church? But it's like, does this change how we vote? Does this change how we sort of do politics? Does this have a broader implication as it relates to racism in America or racism in the world? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's a good thing to point out, that a lot of what Paul and to some extent James as well is doing is sort of pastoral.
Yeah.
Or ecclesial is what...
That's a good big word.
Yeah, McKnight of the church, kind of our church concerned, for those of you who didn't hear it. That's kind of what McKnight says about Romans, that it's not primarily a work of theology, it's an ecclesial work. It's intended mm-hmm. to help the Roman church or churches understand how to relate better. So this is all true, and this is part of the context. But I think we can have some reasonable confidence that these things are supposed to apply beyond just the immediate family of God, in the way that, for example, the sojourner, or the alien, or the traveler, the immigrant, are so often included in these lists of people for whom we're supposed to be concerned.
Yeah.
So, of course, in ancient Israel, the assumption is everybody in there is part of the family of God, except for a few exceptions who move in and who are traveling through or whatever. But there's kind of this exception: we're all part of the family. But now the church is. Now that we're sort of detached from a ethnicity, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. we can maybe start thinking, if we were looking for how do we deal with people outside of the family, one way to start thinking about that is like, well, how did God tell the ancient Israelites to deal with people outside of the family? And it was love your neighbor as yourself.
Sometimes it wasn't very kind.
Well, that's true.
Okay, which is hard to...
Yeah,
it's hard to wrap your mind around,
Yeah, and I realize that I have to simplify and elide things here.
Right.
But so maybe then the point to foot stomp on is when God is giving, is talking about justice and is giving these lists of people to whom his people should show special concern, he explicitly includes people outside the family of God.
Right.
The sojourners within Israel.
Yeah. Yeah. I fear what this makes me sound like, because it feels like this is overly idealistic and kind of like Christian triumphalism a little bit. But like, I feel like I wonder if Paul had a deep conviction that the world is going to be changed and is going to start looking more like the kingdom of God by the church living into what the church ought to be. And what I mean by that is, like, the church has the chance and the responsibility to start living as if everything that's actually true of them is true in reality, meaning that now the church is supposed to be this new kind of humanity, this new place that and body of, like, the new world of what God has always wanted, where ethnic boundaries don't matter for your inclusion, or nothing matters for your inclusion in this family, and we can all actually coexist. And, like, this is this multi-ethnic, just super variant community, and you're going to show the world how this is done, church, because you are the epicenter of, like, new creation life. And so it feels to me like, is there any chance that Paul's hoping for the church to embody this so well and so compellingly that it would show the world, this is how you do it. This is how you live this way. And it would start to, like, affect and infect the world. It would start to go viral. It might sound sort of, again, overly simplistic, but I'm compelled by that. Is, like, is there any way that, like, one of our responses to this whole dilemma is not necessarily that we don't do anything sort of in the city or the state or anything, but we really need to look at our churches and want and long for it to look like the ideal that Paul is describing, and that is going to be powerful. Like, that is the church's vocation in the world. And it's funny because N.T. Wright describes the church as sort of failing at its vocation and of living this way, living into this sort of new humanity kind of lifestyle. And in that failure, like, a secular version has arisen, essentially, of, you know, the Enlightenment and of, like, sort of living with these particular ideals of equality and justice for all, but with none of the like, theological grounding for, like, why that matters. And he's like, the church should have been leading the way on this. The church should have been the one on the doing this better than everyone. And now we're trying to catch up, you know? And so we've sort of failed at this. And I don't exactly know. I wish I was coming to a finer point, but maybe I'm just drawn by how church-centric Paul seems to be here. And maybe I'm wanting to be church-centric too, of, like, how to respond to this. And again, that's not over and against maybe how you vote and how you serve and how you think about other things, but, like, also not to think it doesn't matter. I don't know. Do you have any response to that, either of you? Just kept rambling.
I guess my feeling is sort of this would be, like, the bare minimum of acceptable church.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, well, I mean, even the early church wasn't fully living into this, so I don't know. But that, you know, at a minimum, Christians should be extremely concerned with ensuring that this is what the church looks like.
Right.
A place where the marginalized among us, the socially marginalized among us, are not then marginalized in church as well.
Right.
But are given, you know, all the honor and respect that the privileged receive in the wider culture. And so, I mean, of course, Paul wants to, you know, win the Gentiles for the gospel. So there's some sense in which, of course, this is a ideal. This should be a global model, kind of.
Yeah.
But I don't know if, you know, I don't know if he actually consciously has it in mind that we're gonna solve specific, particularly with, like, the you know, ethnic division. We're, like, that's, like, the mission of the church, is that we're gonna solve that. I'm not so sure about that. But I mean, you know, there is this sense of, like, Jesus by God the Son becoming a man and then dying this shameful death and then, you know, kicking death in the face nonviolently. Mm-hmm. is this new revolutionary approach to power and privilege and right. Empire. So there's themes of that in there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course I understand the desire to avoid Christian triumphalism because I don't think we've really measured up necessarily on all this.
Yeah. I wonder if I'm feeling stuck where it's like what Paul seems to be talking about here is the logical outflowing of, like, the image of God and sort of the hope of even the Abrahamic covenant that was going to be to all nations, like, that needs to become a reality in the church, you know? And it seems to me like maybe it's even a different conversation to take, like, what is the image of God idea, image of God in all people idea and all nations sort of idea? What does that mean for people outside? Like, what does that mean for our relationship to ethics outside the church? Because I feel like I have a sense that it would mean caring deeply about the poor and caring deeply about the marginalized, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, so maybe we can just think about the parable of the Good Samaritan then.
Yeah.
When Jesus is asked, who's my neighbor? by, you know, the scholar looking to justify himself. Mm-hmm. He not only makes it explicit that this neighborliness is supposed to cross, you know, ethnic lines, but he picks the people that his audience would have hated.
Right.
The Samaritans. And says that's the good guy because he, unlike all of the, you know, people you would traditionally think of as righteous from within our own people who walked by the man because they were too scared of the robbers, you know, maybe even understandably so, the Samaritan, yeah, even a Samaritan was able to be a proper neighbor to one of our own. Even though Jesus is kind of, right, he says is primarily or first sent to the Jews, mm-hmm. there is this like, you know, expansive vision even there.
Yeah.
And what it means to love one's neighbor, who we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I apologize. I feel like I brought us down a line of questioning that might not be that helpful for most people, you know, of thinking about this as like a church issue, you know, because we want to talk about it as a broader social issue. You know, how do we think about this in America? Obviously, that's the question of the day. The question of the day is like, why don't the churches look this way necessarily? That might be one question, but I'm just going to read this quote from the Wright article that I was talking about before. So Paul, I mean, N.T. Wright says this. He says, why did we get it so wrong? How has it got to the point where in the last few hundred years, the apparently best educated Christian groups in the world, think of the learned Germans in the 19th century or devout Afrikaners in the 20th, think of Britain and France with their rich cultural heritages, think of America. How has it come about that this imperative towards a polychrome unity has been so far sidelined that the great majority of would-be practicing Christians, instead of taking it for granted, flout it and regard anyone who argues for it as a dangerous subversive? How did we slide into racism without even realizing? What he's arguing about there is like the church's vocation should have been this all along, and how did we miss it, you know? And now I think he's arguing that it's being picked up by other non-church entities, and again, without some of the foundational theological groundings. And I don't know if it's just a lament of his that like, how did we do this? How did we let this happen? Like we should have been on the cutting edge of this or what? And maybe I'm lamenting it too. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's not a rhetorical question,
yeah.
I mean, the answer was it was conscious and it was on purpose.
Yeah.
Most tragically.
Yeah.
So I'll just plug here. We can plug books on the podcast, I assume.
Yeah.
So I'll just plug within Christian theology, Willie James Jennings' book, The Christian Imagination. He talks about some of this history of how the concept of race was developed as a way to classify people and specifically how Christians were involved in this.
Yeah. There you go.
And some biblical interpretation that, yeah. mm-hmm. you know, we have to own.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, there's all the curse of Ham stuff and things like that, but the particularly Christian thing, which I think is just what makes this so egregious, Jennings and also Ibram Kendi in his book Stamped from the Beginning talk about this guy, Zurara, I can't remember his full name, but he was basically like a court scribe maybe in Portugal around the time that Henry the Navigator in, I think, 1444 was bringing back the first enslaved people stolen from Africa. Mm-hmm. And Jennings quotes him and says, you can see how, you know, of course these people are, I mean, devastated by what's happened to them. And then it comes time for the prince to take his spoils and the spoils to be divided up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so families are being separated and Zurara kind of like, you see a little bit of this, like, oh, this is really sad. It almost seems tragic and unjust, but don't worry. They're lucky because we're going to Christianize them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's okay. Right. All this stuff is going to be worth it. You know, yeah, they seem sad now, but don't worry about it because, you know, we're going to save their souls. Mm. And so, I mean, there was really this kind of like, you know, the Great Commission was deployed to justify slavery. And you know, I really like we're running out of time, but like this is not just like a, you know, Zurara did it, he's a jerk kind of thing. Like this theme comes through, like I guess you were saying Stanford too, there was this, you know, sort of this biblical interpretation, which really emphasizes, you know, saving souls and this emphasis that's really placed on slaves being obedient to masters. Mm-hmm. Because originally plantation owners in the United States didn't want to evangelize to the people they'd enslaved because they'd worried they'd hear about the Exodus and things like that. They'd hear about Jesus freeing the captives.
Yeah.
And so they literally, you know, had their own kind of canon where they would only preach certain texts like the, you know, later, I think in Colossians, for example, or 1 Peter, where, you know, slaves obey your masters kinds of stuff without the fuller context of what's going on. Mm. And so the, you know, biblical interpretation is being used to it's not just failing to be a weapon against oppression, which is what it should be, but it's actually being weaponized for oppression.
Yeah.
The teeth are being taken out of the gospel. So slaves are being told about Jesus. And as Esau Macaulay points out in his book, Reading While Black, they're figuring out a lot of the stuff that their enslavers are hiding from them or trying to hide from them. They're figuring out who Jesus is and what he wants for them. But this is, you know, working against what the dominant Christian culture is trying to teach them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it happened, I guess, literally.
Yeah, that's helpful. It doesn't feel like there's much to do right now other than say that you can see after we've put up the passages of what we should be, what the church ought to have been, what the church was made to be, and then to watch and to hear you talk about that, it's like how much we have fallen short, you know, how much we have need of repentance and how much we have need of relearning what it means to be the church, you know, and if we, which seems like undoubtedly so, if we've adopted any of that, needing to retrain our focus of what we ought to be feels crucial. Absolutely crucial. And the baseline, the bare minimum, like you said, you know, but like we must do it. And I'm sort of kicking myself because I wish we had talked more about what you just talked about. It feels like there should be a part two and let's launch from what you just said, but I know we got to go. I'm going to cut it off there unless you have something else, a last word to say.
No, I'm happy to do a part two at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important and it's a tough thing that we, particularly as white American Christians in a historically white church, need to grapple with.
Right, right.
But yeah, that's it.
Well, thank you, Rick, for coming and bringing that. And I know we've gone over, but we want to do some Quarantine Corner. It's America's favorite segment. We can't let them not have it. And so
give
the people what they want. We can go short. I will give you my Quarantine Corner. It's I think it's the lamest one that I've ever had, but I feel it strongly. And my Quarantine Corner is that you should have throw pillows and you should have a lot of them. And the reason you should have throw pillows on your bed, which are just the height of irrelevancy and the height of foolishness, because they're just decoration. You put them on, put them off.
Bourgeois decadence.
Exactly, absolutely. And anyone who's obsessed with efficiency would think this is the stupidest advice. But what happens when you have a million throw pillows is that it creates absolute chaos in your room. There's nowhere to walk because pillows are covering every single square foot of the ground. And so in the morning, you get to bring order from chaos and make your bed, and it looks immaculate. And it's like what once was just chaotic awfulness is now this beautiful, wonderful carpet that you can walk on. And it, you know how they say, like, if you make your bed, it like sets you up for a good day, you know, because you've lived into like something useful. I think with the more throw pillows, that must be the more true. Because you just like, I just created a beautiful looking thing from absolutely chaos. So that's honestly, I was like, I love making the bed and putting up the throw pillows. It looks so good. And I know that it's the height of decadence and lack of efficiency. So anyway, I want you to get throw pillows and I don't even care if it's lame. So that's my Quarantine Corner.
I didn't think there was any way you were going to land that, Peter. But as someone who is addicted to efficiency to the point of idolatry, I actually found that mildly compelling.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Mine's on topic a little bit. I'm part of a group that's bringing some speakers to Davis on this topic, and so we've been reading a bunch of books. And as kind of like a cold empirical engineer, the thinking on this topic that I just find the most compelling is some of the like really evidential brain science stuff. And so I'm just going to recommend Jennifer Eberhardt. She's a researcher down at Stanford who's doing and she's part of a tradition of kind of bias research. And if you're kind of like very super evidential and are really interested in kind of maybe a starting point into this literature, I find her to be a pretty helpful starting point.
I love it. That's great. Rick, bring us home, man. Give us Quarantine Corner.
Well, I feel compelled to say, Peter, if you wanted the perfectly smooth landing, you could have mentioned like the kind of co-creation that you're engaging in and bringing order from disorder, proper Hebrew Bible kind of theme.
That's right. That's true.
That's why he won me over, is he knows that's one of my themes.
And So, and for what it's worth, is just somebody who likes to be empirically minded as well. I guess it was history that really brought me into a lot of this. Mm-hmm. Just learning the history really changed my mind, changed my thinking. But anyway, that's not my quarantine corner. My quarantine corner, I think that you should learn to do a handstand. That's what I've been trying to do, okay, for about 2 weeks. So it's like a very serious, like life, you know, almost a calling, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
I've been reading this book called Overcoming Gravity, and trying to do a little bit of gymnastic strength training, because those guys are really strong, and it's just phenomenal. And so the first easy thing he says, you know, everybody should kind of start with his handstands. So I've been, you know, learning to kick up against the wall and do all of this. But the way you're supposed to do it, you see, is belly to the wall.
Really?
You can imagine the problem with this. Yeah, it helps you like get the good body line or something. I don't know. I think that's a term they use, body line.
Yeah.
But the reason for this, or sorry, the effect of this is that if you fall, you're basically going to backflop unless you properly, you know, kind of combat roll out of it. And so I thought, well, safety first. So I'm going to practice my rolls. So that when I fall, this doesn't happen to me. And so I practice a couple of rolls, kind of like, you know, basically somersaults. And then I say, okay, now I'm going to go up on the wall, and I'm not going to go all the way up, right? I'm just going to be part way down and then practice a roll out of it. So if I, you know, so I don't kill myself here. And I just about gave myself a concussion. I've never had a problem rolling, but somehow lowering myself on my arms and trying to kind of, you know, make contact with the floor just basically resulted in my head slamming into the floor, followed by my shoulder, I think I was saved from a full backflop because my feet were caught by the bookshelf. And so I kind of, you know, then sort of rolled into the ground that way, but it was not deliberate, but it's great. No, it's really fun. When you do get that, like, for 3 seconds balanced on your hands, you just feel like just a champion.
King of the world. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's amazing.
I am
Honey,
Morgan
come
Ham.
In and look at this. Yeah. Yeah. Look what I just did.
Look at me.
Yeah.
That's great. Exactly. Yeah. So we got something for your morning routine. We got something for your reading, and we got something for exercise. We're helping people be ordered
that's
people.
Right. Yeah. What else could you want, really?
All right. Well, that's it for us. Thanks again, Rick. And thanks, Stanford, for this conversation.
Yeah. Take care, guys.
Bye, guys.
All right. That is it for this week's episode. A very, very special thank you to Rick Morris for just your passion and your wisdom. You've led us to a place, I think, of seeing who we are and who we're supposed to be more clearly. And you've painted a picture of what we can be at our best. And I'm hoping that God would give us the grace to become that. And we want to thank Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung for the music of Your Pod and Your Staff. It is musical magic. And also thank Mike Loretto for editing our show and being just a delight to work with. So you can connect with him about editing or spiritual coaching on his website, which will be in the show notes. But to close, for now, College Life, you should know that we love you even more than Natalie and Paige love the human thumb. We'll see you next week.